This hour, we're whetting your appetite by listening back to our favorite moments from Carrie Miller's recent foodie roundtables at the fair. Andrew Zimmern joined us again in 2014, along with Food Network host Amy Thielen, Pizzeria Lola chef and owner Ann Kim, and Heartland Restaurant chef and owner Lenny Russo. And here's something you should know. Carrie Miller is not an adventurous eater. So when Lenny Russo brought up his latest food project, Carrie had some questions.
I want to talk to you guys about bison, because Lenny, on the way over here, you were talking to me about you're creating some new dishes. You're working with bison.
Well, we just brought a whole bison in, and so we were taking it apart this morning.
Right. I don't need the details of that.
Different pieces.
Right.
And so we had a lot of trim, so we grounded. We wanted to see what kind of bison burger we would get. Would it be tasty? Would it be dry? Would it be, you know,
yeah, chewy? Yeah. So why is bison especially lean? Why do we want to eat bison? They're so cute. I don't know why I'd want to eat them.
It's all sorts of cute animals we eat, like bunny rabbits and...
Okay. This is going in a direction I didn't quite expect, the first part of this conversation.
We eat from too narrow a choice at the buffet table.
Meaning
that if somebody has a bison meal once a month or goes vegetarian once a week or incorporates a small local fish with its head on it, be it from a lake, a river, or an ocean, once a month, that's three or four meals that don't come from a large-scale commercialized ag that are practicing non-sustainable methodologies.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. So the more choice that we have and the more we dip into other things as a nation and as a planet, I mean, we're overfishing certain species into extinction because we're addicted to, you know, tuna, let's say. Let's eat some, you know, little porgies and bluefish and, you know, lake
trout. Amy, what were you going
to
say?
I just think, it comes down to a big three of beef, chicken, pork. Which, I mean, I love all three of those things.
Me too.
I totally agree. Let's expand,
Maybe it's getting access, Anne, to some of the... Yeah.
I agree with what everyone is saying here. When I was growing up, my mother served parts that you would normally throw away. Andrew was talking about tongue, beef tongue. That was something we had on the dinner table almost once a week.
Really?
Chicken livers, shortbreads that my mother would do and stir fry and add vegetables from the garden. And so that was my norm. Going to Kentucky Fried Chicken or McDonald's on a Sunday was a delight, you know. So that's what I grew up with, and I think if people get more accustomed to that, they'll realize how really tasty and delicious it is.
Lenny?
Yeah. Well, I thought the big three were bison, rabbit, and turtle. So.
Turtle? But, really? Are you doing a lot with turtle?
Yeah, we do work with snapping turtles out of Iowa. As a matter of fact, Andrew did a show on snapping turtles, and
five different types of mussels. I mean, I feel like I'm preaching to the converted when I lean this way. But when people
lean my way,
when
I need
people
to be
taste it, they're absolutely blown away by it. And you know, like goats, certain types of animals can be raised to harvest quickly. It can be done sustainably. It's good economic practice. It's good. You know, we have to figure out a way to feed a planet that's getting increasingly hungry.
Right.
So whether it's plant-based foods, whether it's an assortment of different animals, we've concentrated our focus too narrowly. I mean, we could spend a whole day talking about this issue. So the degree to which great chefs, restaurateurs, food writers, TV people can expose folks to great ideas about meats that, by the way, is also local here in Minnesota, where there are farmers trying to make a living with some of these animals. If we can develop a need for them and a passion for them, I mean, anyone who goes to Heartland is going to get exposed to those kinds of things in the same way that they get exposed to an egg on a pizza.
But don't you? I mean, if the idea, the ethic is to eat more locally, then there are going to be some things that you, at certain times of the year, that you just don't have access to. Is that, that's something Dan Barber writes about, right?
Sure.
And that's something, is that the way it ought to be?
Right. Well, and I think, I'm sorry, Amy, Dan also wrote about proper crop rotation.
Yes.
And how cover crop needs to also be consumed. So if you're buying emmer wheat, for instance, from a farmer and the cover crop behind it is red kidney beans, you need to buy those too. So we've been cooking with those cover crops for 12 years at Heartland, and so I was really happy to see Dan talk about
that. But Amy, I mean, what that might mean is that if Lenny wants to serve heirloom tomatoes on salads in February, well, then you're not eating locally. I mean, it is potentially going to limit your options.
Well, I just want to say about the meat thing, venison up north is completely common. I mean, I'm from Park Rapids, and I live there again now. And people hunt, and there's, deep freezers all around full of venison. People eat it a lot. We do, too.
Who eats venison out here a lot?
Look at how many hands.
Oh, yeah. You don't really need to convert anybody.
It's kind of an underground thing in Minnesota.
In Louisiana, I mean, we've documented this on my show, Out the Wazoo. We meet people all the time from all walks of life who, exclusively eat wild pig, venison, rabbit. I mean, things that they go out and shoot themselves, put in their food locker or freezer, and eat off that all winter. And then there's shrimp and fish in its season. And it is a different approach to living that we actually have been doing for tens of thousands of years.
Anne, how do you think about this?
Well, I think we're talking a lot about meat and proteins, but I think more about vegetables. How can we in Minnesota, where our growing season is about 3 months long, how can we preserve that?
Right.
And I grew up in a household where we pickled, fermented, and saved vegetables that way. I remember come October, November, we would get together with the family and fill up our kiddie swimming pool to brine cabbage to have kimchi to last us throughout the winter. That was sort of a rite of passage. That was how we could preserve and eat. And when it got funky and just got really bubbly, that's when we would put it in stews and stir fries. And that's how, for me, that's how we took the summer season into the winter. And then spring comes and we renew it again.
Okay, so in the winter, when you wanted it, you would go out and dip something into the kiddie swimming pool and bring it back into the kitchen and cook with it?
No, I mean, because we couldn't find a bowl big enough to actually brine, that was pretty much the biggest bowl we could find was our pool.
You started to get at something, though, with the tomato thing. And yes, I think to a large degree, we need to say no to certain things at certain times of the season.
When you say we, you
as
also mean chefs,
everyone.
Too, right?
Come September, if I see one more tomato mozzarella basil salad, I'm going to shoot myself. I'm dying for cassoulet. And the minute you said beans, I was like, oh, yeah. Because you can start to feel the temperature turn. And by honoring cooking with the seasons, you look forward to those first greens of spring more so than you would if you were just eating them all the time. It's better for our planet. But I think to Anne's point, the beauty of where we're at today with food propagation and with farming issues is that we can figure out a way to extend those seasons. And we can figure out ways with, hydroponics, aquaculture, hoop houses, old technologies, new technologies, bring choice and variety into our lives in a different way where it doesn't have to come off of some sort of giant factory farm in Florida and get jetted up here. The carbon footprint thing is a little bit of a misnomer. Sometimes it's actually better for our planet to fly up 50,000 pounds of bananas from Ecuador than it is to be trucking stuff from all over Texas at a certain time of year. So it gets confusing for the consumer.
Right.
But I think that the gatekeepers on this need to become more aware and more educated.
Lenny, what were you going to say?
Well, don't think we're not serving heirloom tomatoes in the winter, but they've been dehydrated or they've been canned or they've been pureed and frozen. And the reason for that is that at some point, and it's coming up very shortly, my farmers will come to me and say, I have, 500 pounds of heirloom tomatoes. They need to go somewhere. So I'll say, bring them all in and we'll process them and put them up for the winter. And that's, quite frankly, how we stay in local crop through the winter. Besides the storage crop of root vegetables, potatoes, onions, apples, things like that, we have canned and preserved all season long. And we're putting up the larder right now, so it'll be ready.
Corn pudding and
yummy
tomatoes.
Sounds good.
Is one of the greatest dishes known to man in the middle of winter.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to an NPR News Presents at the Minnesota State Fair, and it's a special foodie roundtable. Andrew Zimmern, Lenny Russo, Ann Kim, Amy Thielen with us, and a great crowd. The weather held out for us. No rain. Okay. We've also got some trivia questions here. And any questions that you want to ask of our roundtablers out here in the audience? Do we have it? Yes, sir. Right behind you guys. Right over there.
What year was the Pronto Pup introduced to the State Fair?
You know, I happen to know that because I was looking for trivia questions. But do you guys know what year the Pronto Pup was introduced? How did you happen to know this?
Heritage?
Okay. All right.
46?
Who wants to take a guess?
46?
I would say earlier. I would say, I'm just going to say the teen decade. I don't know.
You already get a prize because you stumped two of the foodies. Does anybody else know?
I have no idea. I haven't been to the fair in 7 years, so.
Oh, and
I don't even know the difference between a corn dog and a Pronto Pup.
How'd she get on this round table? You know, we didn't know that.
Sorry.
But now that you've been here, you'll be back.
I'll be back. I walked by the miracle of life, and I cried. It was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. See what you've been missing? Sir, the answer to, and the on the microphone.
1947.
Excellent. Oh. Good job. Good job.
Is that after the war because they switched to, is there some sort of thing with the grain? Because the Pronto Pup's wheat, right?
Right.
Wiener done in a bun.
That might be it. That might actually be
Wiener,
it.
Wiener done in a bun.
Yeah. Done in a bun. No. D-U-N in a bun.
I'm sure it is. I mean, a lot of, you know, one of the things when we were talking about before about all the vegetables and meats and different choices, there was a time for thousands of years where we ate out of necessity and global, you know, cataclysms would create new food trends, whether it's Spam or a deep-fried corn or Pronto Pup dog. I mean, there's lots of them. The beauty of food history is that you look back, you can learn lessons about how we might want to make some different choices moving forward as well.
And that's how we have a corn dog on our bar menu right now. We made, we crafted a bunch of smoked kielbasa for the St. Paul Saints, and the batch that came out, the links were too short. So we decided, well, we have like 500 of these.
Somebody's going to eat them, right?
So we just jammed them on a stick and dipped them in some corn batter. And yeah.
We get the truth of how stuff ends up on the menus, right, at the restaurants. Okay, I have a trivia question for you guys. We'll see if you know. Here it is. This food is named after a tree or a shrub that is named after the horse chestnut tree. It is also, here's a hint, it is also the nickname of a U.S. state. It's a fair food. It's named after a tree or a shrub. Don't look at my notes here, Amy. And it's named after the horse chestnut tree. And it's the nickname of a U.S. state. And if you get the nickname, if you get that, the U.S. state, there's a special extra prize. Who knows?
Do you want the state first?
Wow.
Ohio.
Come on, really?
Buckeyes, Ohio.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And where... And what's the food?
Well, it's the Buckeye things. They're chocolate, and I'm not sure what else.
Deep fried.
Yeah,
deep fried Buckeyes.
Deep fried.
I thought for sure this was going to go on and on, and nobody was going to get that.
This is a smart crowd.
Oh my gosh, I know you guys. Okay.
Did you like the Buckeye bites?
Them.
Oh, all right.
Well, now you have to.
All right.
Now I have to go over there and try them.
Deep fried peanut butter nom noms on a stick.
Have you? You've eaten them?
No, I won't.
Why? What?
Well, there are certain things that hold no allure for me because I have other things on the priority list to get down. I'm sure they're very good. It does. I just deep fried candy or peanut butter holds no special magic for me. I want to try other. I mean, there's so many other great foods here that are made from scratch.
What's
that
at the
are
top
really
of your list
quality.
Right now?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, one of the things that I think is amazing about this year is how much great Minnesota beer and wine is represented here. And I know that sounds...
All those special beers,
well,
you mean?
Well, here's what I think is great. It's local. It's made by us, for us. And I'm not trying to be, you know, ethnocentric in some way. I just think it's about time. I just see less and less of the, you know, national brands and more, you know, local breweries all sharing statewide the same sort of space and giving people a taste of what our culture is all about. And they're doing fun flavored beers and limited runs out here. But it's everything from the far north all the way down to some of the, you know, hipster breweries in the city. And there's a different spirit that comes along with that. Just like the increase of people who are doing live local music in their booths and stuff.
Right.
I think it really adds, it adds to the what makes this fair great and special.
Somebody
as opposed to taking away from that or making it more derivative of what other people are doing.
Somebody was talking about the oatmeal stout beer I think. And there's like many different flavors in there. You guys might be new this year. Anybody tried that?
Mini donuts
this
year? Blueberry?
Yeah, there's some real different flavors here.
How's the apple cider? I love going to the apple booth in the Hort Egg. That's my favorite place.
Yeah? We get apple cider
and
there?
The honey.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, the honey ice cream is kind of phenomenal,
too. Well, the horticulture building, if people are walking around at the fair and not going to the permanent buildings, horticulture, creative activities, the animal barns, I mean, that's why we come every day, so we can spend a lot of time in those places. It's remarkable.
Right.
Horticulture building is fantastic.
You literally come every single day.
It ends up being 10 or 11 out of 12, but yes, we do.
Right. Oh. Yeah. I love Hort Egg. I grew up going to the Hort Egg building. That was like, it's my favorite spot. We're going right after this.
Giant pumpkin.
Question right out there.
The blueberry beer is delicious.
Is that new this year, or have they always had that?
I think it's new.
Okay. So you've already sampled that?
Yes,
all right,
it's delicious.
Good. Okay, right out there.
Andrew, I was wondering if there's any way we could get you to come down and try Lutefisk.
Oh.
I've eaten Lutefisk a lot, and as a chef, I will just tell you, bacalao and all its varieties, all manners of salt cod, and how it is revived and put into dishes and consumed is one of my favorite foods in the world. Whether it's brandad, whether it's in a braise, I am nuts about salted cod. How on earth, with all respect, anybody then soaks it in lye, then has to rehydrate it for 3 to 9 days, and then it comes out as sort of like fermented fish jello. And I love fermented fishy things. When you talked about rotten uni, I have a Korean chef friend who made fermented uni for me that was about 60 days old, that was one of the most stinky but remarkable foods, like cheese, that I'd ever had. But lutefisk to me is just a deal closer.
I don't get lutefisk.
It.
Sir, what is the... It doesn't taste like anything. What's the appeal?
You pour the melted butter on it and just start eating it.
It's all about the
butter.
You
put melted butter on anything. Why slimy
butter
fish?
Butter is the new bacon.
Right. I'm married into a Norwegian-American family, and my husband's aunts are right there.
They are?
Every
Where
year,
are they?
They're right here.
Ah, hey.
I am in charge of cooking the lutefisk. Usually my mother-in-law kind of like lobs it to me last minute, like 15 minutes out, and she says, oh, the lutefisk. And so I cook it. You know, a little, it's all about the butter. I get it. But it's the one Norwegian thing that I can't get into. I
know.
Agree with you, Anna.
They were surprised to hear you say that. A microphone right over there. What? Why? Why the lutefisk, you three?
Tradition.
Is that
my dad loved it?
It doesn't matter if it doesn't taste good. It's all about tradition.
Well, I have a very small serving every year. Once a year, that's it, with butter. And I can eat it. That's it.
There's food I'm sure that we all go and eat and love.
Yeah, you're right.
It isn't about it being the best taste.
Exactly right.
It's about the other stuff around it. Fascinating to me, having created shows in Norway, is that more lutefisk is consumed here in Minnesota than in Norway.
I believe.
So it says something about whose tradition we're upkeeping, and I think that's the charming aspect of it. Yeah. In Norway, they've given up on lutefisk.
Well, that's how...
What's wrong with you three? They've given up on it.
They're from a town called Norseland in southern Minnesota, so it's all about preserving that heritage,
That's how St. Patrick drove the Norwegians out of Ireland.
With lutefisk?
Well, what happened was when the Vikings stopped there on their way west, they were getting all the good fish, and the Irish were upset, so they asked St. Patrick what to do, and he told them to poison them by putting lye on their fish. But it turned out they really loved it, and so then he told them to go to hell, and they all moved to North Dakota.
Lenny. Okay, I wanted to... What you were saying, Andrew, about... sometimes it's the food we eat that it's really all about, like your childhood experience or your family experience. And you might go back and eat that food as an adult and think, what was this really about? But it's all about the nostalgia and the experience of a child in eating that food, right?
Oh, I 100% agree. And I think what Amy's aunt, is that your aunt?
Yeah.
Said about tradition. She eats lutefisk because of tradition. For me, all food is rooted, deeply rooted in tradition, in family, cultural heritage. Even the pizza that we make at Pizzeria Lola, we've got traditional Italian-style pies and Americana-type pies with pepperoni and house-made fennel sausage, but I've got two pies on there that are directly related to my heritage of being Korean and happen to be the number one selling pie, which is the Korean barbecue.
Wow, really?
Which is basically short ribs that's marinated in a traditional Korean barbecue sauce and really grilled and just charred and placed on the pizza. And then the Lady Zaza, which is a pizza with kimchi that we make in-house, my mother's recipe, her mother's recipe, and so on and so forth. And that, to me, is what eating is about.
That was Ann Kim, Pizzeria Lola chef and owner. She was on our annual Foodie Roundtable back in 2014. We're listening back to our favorite moments from this state fair tradition here on NPR Day. Let's go back one year when Carrie's guests were Spoon and Stable pastry chef Diane Yang, Same Wade from World Street Kitchen and Saffron, and Food Network's Amy Thielen. Amy is also the author of The New Midwestern Table. So when Carrie asked about her family's influence on her cooking, Amy had to talk about her grandmother.
So, Amy, you've talked about how interested people are in relearning the things that their grandparents or even their great-grandparents taught them or the things that they were doing in their kitchens. And I was wondering if the kind of experimental chef that you are and the kind of interest that you have in food was influenced by what your great-grandparents were doing or what your grandparents were doing.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's all over my book. I mean, my grandma, Addie Dion, was a huge influence. And I visited her bench at the fair. She
your
has
grandma's
a bench.
Bench. Where,
yeah,
where's
she,
that?
She passed away about 10 years ago, and so we got her a bench. And it's on Nelson by the giant slide.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got her a bench at the fair because she entered the fair. She entered her bread in the fair a lot. And as a teenager, she won some big grand prize ribbon here at the fair.
So what makes that bread, and do you still bake it, unusual,
yeah,
uniquely so delicious?
A lot of the things that she made, I think this is typical of like that era, that farm cooking era,
right,
that she was from. They seem really simple, but there's so many little subtle details that make it awesome. And her bread, really, it had this potato base. So it was like a potato water base and a little bit of mashed potato. And that's really typical.
Mashed potato in the bread.
Yeah, so it's like potato bread. It makes it softer. And actually, they used the potato water that came off of the boiling of the potatoes for noon lunch.
Yeah.
They fermented that, and they used it as a natural yeast.
So I need that in my life.
You knew that, right?
I need that in my life.
Yeah.
Yes, that sounds so good.
I know. So it's just like, you know, white bread, but then you break it down. It's got the potato sourdough, and then it has the flour. Wasn't just plain white flour, but back in the day, they were grinding, making a real fine flour, but they left the germ in it. So it was like this kind of speckled. You know, when you go to France and people talk about like, oh my gosh, there's something about the croissants there. They have these like little bit of speckle in it. Yep. That's what it is. And Swanee White.
I love Swanee White.
They're still doing that, and they'll sell it to you in a 25-pound bag. I mean, Diane, you know everything about there is to know about flour. But yeah, so a recipe like that, which seems, you know, on the surface simple, but when you get into it, is really kind of complex and interesting.
So do you guys think that these are the kinds of things that, you know, the average person would taste and know what they're tasting, or are they the secrets that make the dish, you know, really memorable?
I think that's the secrets, to be honest with you. I don't think the average person is really thinking that deep about it.
Right.
But it's something that just hits somewhere in your mind, in your kind of memory cells, that this is something special.
I mean, this is, well, you've just said it. This is really about pinging that memory, even if you're not fully aware of it, being able to taste nostalgia in some ways, right?
Eating is emotions.
Right.
Right? So, you know, you eat when you're happy, you eat when you're sad. At least I do. That's why I look so sexy.
You do look sexy.
Because I love to eat when I'm sad, and I eat when I'm happy. So
Diane,
eat your emotions.
What do you think about whether
I totally think it's just from memories, too. Because, like, my dad, my mom worked a lot, but my dad, you know, like, it was all the simple stuff. Like, he made pickled catfish and pickled mustard greens. It's, like, the simplest things,
That sounds
but I still
awesome.
Remember them. Yeah. But I can't make it. I cannot.
Really?
Oh, he has his... Only him, my dad and my brother can make this pickle mustard, and I truly believe it's like the oil in your hand or something. Like, he adds salt, and he muddles it and, like, cans it, and it ferments. Me, my mom, my sister, we can't do it to save our life. Like, just doesn't come out. It rots in the can instead of ferments.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
She's really good at pastries. She's really, really good at pastries. Yeah.
I do desserts.
So what's the dessert, then, that, even if it's not a specific dessert that was passed down through the family, but it's the taste that you evoke from your family that gets into this favorite dish? Is there one?
You know, my mom, you know, being brought up in a Hmong household, we ate a lot of, like, tapioca and pearls. So my mom always makes, like, this coconut tapioca pudding that it is delicious. And she makes a version that can be eaten warm or hot. I mean, warm or cold.
Yeah.
And it's pretty delicious. And my daughter loves it, and she still asks for it. We just made some last night, so...
And, you know, that's funny because I think of tapioca as, I mean, somewhat bland, that there is... Would I be able to tell one super special tapioca from another? I don't know.
No, it's how you cook it, and it's what you add to it. You know, the how much water to get the thickness of it, and how much sugar and coconut and the love you put into it.
Right.
You taste the love.
Yeah. Can you taste the love?
Absolutely.
Come on.
The love is chewy.
Chefs yes. say that.
Oh, it's so true. It's so true.
You can
when
totally,
you eat a sandwich that was not made with love, you taste the sadness.
You can totally tell.
You can tell. It's just not as delicious.
Who believes that or not?
Yeah, let's see a raise of hands. Yes, absolutely.
Really? Especially sandwiches. What is up with that?
What's the love? I mean, come on. What's true. If I... Okay, microphone right over there, Marquita. If I feel like if I'm tasting a sandwich from a master sandwich maker, love or not, I'm getting a good meal. No?
Yes, because he probably loves what he's doing.
Exactly.
But if you're in a bad mood or crabby or whatever, I come home, make dinner, make the same thing I've made 1,000 times. It just doesn't come out the same as it does when I'm in a good mood and really feeling connected to the ingredients and the whole process.
I like what you said about connected to the ingredients. So what is that? How do you think of that?
Well, I think of it as, I'm a chef too, but I don't have a job now. I just moved up here from Chicago. But I think of it as procuring things that are quality, that are raised in a healthy way, that you can identify and have an appreciation for, that you're now going to feed your family and friends. And then, so you're connected that way, and then also you're physically connected by touching and feeling, particularly when you're making pastries and other things with your hands. So it's both a physical and an emotional connection, I think.
Well said. Welcome to the Twin Cities.
Beautiful.
Good to have
I'm
you.
I'm hiring, by the way, so come on and apply.
I know.
I need more people like that in my life.
What would you say to that?
Oh, that's perfect. That's spot on. That's exactly what I look forward to. I run my kitchens at the restaurants as if they're kind of a place where cooks can come, learn, and have fun. If they're not having fun, I can feel it in the food. I can taste it in the food. They're not enjoying themselves. My job is to make sure that the food tastes great, and I feel like the food tastes better when they're smiling and we're happy.
You know, I did restaurant work out in the front of the house. It can be a grind. I mean, you're telling me that every day your cooks and your staff are coming in and they're infusing all of this food with love and commitment?
Absolutely.
They're passionate.
If they're not with me. They're with somebody else.
But, you know, a kitchen can have that camaraderie in the back, you know, that's so awesome.
Right.
I mean, you feel like a family. The kitchens I worked in, I felt like family in those places, the good ones, you know?
Diane, you were going to say.
We are family. Everyone we work with, I work 14, 15-hour days, and I'm at work with my coworkers more than I'm at home with my family.
Right.
So it is family. But everyone that comes to work, I don't think it's a job. It's like coming in and being passionate and love doing what you do.
It's a lifestyle.
That's Diane Yang, the executive pastry chef at Spoon and Stable in Minneapolis, along with Sammy Wadi of World Street Kitchen and Saffron, and the Food Network's Amy Thielen. They were all on our foodie roundtable at the Minnesota State Fair last year. We've been listening to all this food talk because today is MPR Day at the fair.